Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 6th of February. Yesterday, we were supposed to see the beginning of a wide open debate about where we should go now in Iraq, the first bipartisan confrontation between Congress and the White House since the invasion 4 years ago. What happened? We're going to be talking about how Republicans held together and blocked a Senate debate over Iraq, even those who had sponsored resolutions, bipartisan resolutions, non-binding resolutions, opposing a surge in troops. Everyone says there will be a debate on the war eventually, although it's hard to make sense of what happened yesterday, and we'll try and do that right at the top of the show. We also have one of our Wisconsin senators, Senator Russ Feingold, being very outspoken about this whole issue and criticizing the Democrats, saying that they're too weak, they are too timid to take on the war directly. He has a resolution that would stop really funding of the war. Troops would be out in 6 months from the passage of a bill, and then there would be no funding. But it's off to a start that's kind of, we're not getting the debate that we thought we would get, and maybe that the American people were voting for a rigorous debate on this whole issue and a good way forward as a result of the elections in November. We're going to take on this issue the first hour of our program today. Craig Gilbert will be joining us to discuss where the various members of the Wisconsin congressional delegation stand on this issue. Do they favor a debate? How did they vote? Do they think that Senator Feingold is way out there, or do they agree with his idea? What do they think about non-binding resolution? A little bit later, we'll speak with a professor of political science from Rutgers University who has served on the staffs of, well, a number of different people, Republicans and Democrats, Senator Walter Mondale, also Chuck Hagel, Patrick Leahy, and others. So let's try and make sense of this. And, you know, you're the people, so what do you think ought to happen here? 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Craig, thanks for being with us. Oh, I'm sorry, I got the wrong button. There we go. Got to press the right button. Hi, Craig.
Good morning.
Yeah. What the heck happened yesterday? I got to tell you, I watched the news reports, and then I read online, and I still couldn't figure out what went on yesterday.
Well, actually, it wasn't that unusual circumstance for the United States Senate. There was basically a procedural standoff. The Democrats, you know, want to be able to kind of control the debate and the number of resolutions that are being offered and the terms of the debate, and the Republicans are trying to get a vote on some additional resolutions. And so there's, you know, members on each side, you know, tend to vote with their party leadership on matters of procedure. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit of a standoff right now. I think most people expect that to work itself out. It's kind of a poker game, and the sort of the side that kind of that feels more political heat and more political pressure will end up, you know, making more concessions procedurally, and then they'll move on and we'll get to the heart of the matter.
So we are going to have a wide and open debate on Iraq.
Well, I think there will be a debate. I think there's people on both sides feel the pressure to have a debate. Right now they're fighting over, advantage going into the debate. And that's very typical of the Senate. And the reason why you have these problems in the Senate is because these things can't proceed without the agreement of the minority party.
I see. What's the story with the Democrats needed 60 votes in order for what? For the Warner 11 non-binding resolution to be discussed yesterday? Is that what was going on?
Well, you need 60 votes to do anything controversial in the Senate because mm-hmm. of the filibuster rule. I mean, all a filibuster is, it's not somebody sitting up there talking, you know, for 5 days on end. A filibuster is just the minority side saying, you know, if you want to do this, you need 60 votes, and we're gonna demand that you get the 60 votes, or we're gonna delay. Mm-hmm. And that's the way the Senate works. So there has to be an agreement on how to proceed, and that either comes with one side getting 60 votes, or it just comes from the leaders on both sides, you know, cutting a deal and having an understanding. Mm-hmm. And then once that happens, you know, the expectation has always been that once the way is cleared for a debate, the measure will be voted on, but it will still need 60 votes to act to be approved. Since these things are symbolic and since we're talking about a non-binding resolution, you know, it will still have, I think, carry some symbolic importance if it falls short of the 60 votes, but there won't be a legislation.
Right. What is Senator Feingold is all over the place on this because of his maybe unusual, maybe not. Tell me how unusual his idea is concerning the war. His resolution would get the troops out 6 months from whenever his bill was passed. He really was taking on the Democrats when I was watching him last night, saying they're just timid on this, they're weak on this, they need to be unified and come up with a plan on their own. Where does Wisconsin stand on this particular issue? Is he way to the left of where the American people, where the people in Wisconsin want to be on the issue, or is he gathering support here?
I don't think he's way to the left. I mean, he wants to legislate an end to the war. A lot of people would like the war to be over. Now, people differ over how to do that and over what particular action Congress should be taking. His position is he wants to get out of Iraq, and he wants to legislate an end to the war in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that position, you know, I think everybody would say that position has more support than it did a year ago or 6 months ago or 2 years ago. I think that's, you know, kind of been his position from the very beginning. He voted against the resolution in 2002 to authorize the use of force in Iraq. He's offered a variety of plans and proposals since then. To push, you know, to sort of push forward for timelines for withdrawal. And, you know, in all these cases, he's certainly been ahead of where the general public is, and he's been ahead of where the party, if you define the party as the Democratic caucus in Congress, he's been ahead of them. But I was at an event over the weekend, the Democratic National Committee winter meetings.
Were you there? Great.
Sure. And all the presidential candidates spoke. And, you know, this was after Feingold offered his, you know, after he came out against the non-binding resolution. And the interesting thing was, you know, if you go into that room, again, we're talking about hardcore Democrats, Democratic activists and party officials. That's where they are. I mean, they're not satisfied with a non-binding resolution.
Mm-hmm.
So what you saw that was interesting on Friday and Saturday of last week was you saw most of the party's presidential candidates, particularly the ones who aren't sitting in Congress, take something much closer to the Feingold position, which is that, you know, it's not good enough to pass a non-binding resolution. You had Hillary Clinton in the somewhat awkward position of kind of defending, you know, this incremental limited step in front of an audience of people who want to get out of Iraq.
Right.
And that was the dynamic.
Right, except that she said if she had been president, we never would have gone, which probably didn't satisfy them, right?
No, I think, you know, again, she was sort of, what they heard was Hillary Clinton saying, well, it takes 60 votes to do this in the Senate. It's not easy, and this is sort of a good first step.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really not what they want to hear. They want to hear people, and, you know, arguably, that's all correct, but what people want to hear is, they want to hear a way out, and
right.
They want Congress to be aggressive. This is, again, I'm talking about core Democrats. They want Congress to be aggressive about this.
Where does Senator Cole stand on all of this, Craig?
Senator Cole supports the non-binding resolution against the surge. He's against the surge. He has not supported going a whole lot further than that. He certainly has not expressed support the idea of either a hard timetable for withdrawal or for cutting off funds.
Mm-hmm. And what about members of the House? Do we have any who are firmly in the president's corner on this issue?
Well, we've only got three Republican members of the House of Congress these days.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a little bit of a spectrum there. I think, you know, certainly all Republicans are unhappy about the way things are going. I think Congressman Sensenbrenner, you know, has been somewhat supportive of, you know, staying behind the president. Congressman Ryan has actually kind of said, I'm reserving judgment on the surge. He's got a trip coming up to Iraq, and he's basically said, when I go up there and I see things on the ground and I come back, I'll be ready to talk about whether I think the surge is a good idea or not. But he's against passing resolutions opposing you know, what the U.S. is doing. And Congressman Petri has been the most sort of critical of any of the Republican lawmakers from Wisconsin about what's going on over there. There have been some cases in the past where he's voted on some appropriations issues where he's kind of dissented from the Republican majority. So I don't know how, you know, whether he's going to want to vote for a non-binding resolution against the war or not. But he's just rhetorically, he's taken a somewhat more skeptical slash critical view of what's going on over there than the majority of House Republicans.
Mm-hmm. And your best prediction as to when we're going to see some debate on this issue rather than people...
Well, the House is saying that they're going to... The Democratic leadership in the House is saying that they're going to go ahead next week with the debate on their side. They were, you know, they assumed the Senate would act this week and then they'd act after the Senate. If the Senate doesn't act this week, they're saying we're going to go ahead and do it anyway because the week after that is a recess and they want to get something done before then.
Yeah.
We don't know. We don't know what form this is going to take. We don't know exactly which resolutions. The Democratic members of the House from Wisconsin have been, have not really been, had a whole lot to say about, you know, the resolutions because, first of all, we don't know exactly what form they're going to take. They've all been critical of the surge, but how they vote on individual resolutions, we won't know until we know what the resolutions say. I mean, you could have some members like Feingold decide that they're against the surge and they don't think the resolutions go far enough and lack teeth. Certainly, Gwen Moore and Tammy Baldwin have been pretty vocal opponents of the war.
Mm-hmm.
So you could see some members like that take that position, and you could see others willing to vote for a non-binding resolution, but not for a whole lot more. Congressman Obie obviously is in the thick of this.
Right, yeah.
Chairman of the Appropriations Committee. And then, you know, in some ways, the real key vote is not so much going to be on the resolutions, but on this supplemental spending request mm-hmm. for the war that the president has put forward.
Yeah. Craig, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, giving us a sense of what happened yesterday and some discussion about where the Wisconsin congressional delegation stands on all the resolutions that are out there. We continue our conversation in just one moment with Professor Ross Baker. I'll tell you all about him. He has a very interesting background. We're talking about the resolutions before the Senate, how the House will take up the issue of funding for the war, what the heck happened yesterday and why Republicans decided to be Republicans, even those who had sponsored the non-binding resolutions, keeping the debate from opening on the Senate floor, a full-fledged debate about what we do next in Iraq. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us now is Professor Ross Baker, Professor of Political Science, and he is at Rutgers University. He was at the Brookings Institution as a research associate before coming to Rutgers. He's the author of The Afro-American, Friend and Foe in the U.S. Senate, The New Fat Cats, House and Senate, and American Government. He's a regular contributor to the editorial pages of the L.A. Times and Newsday, and his commentaries have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, the Boston Globe, and on National Public Radio's All Things Considered. Interesting background. He served on the staffs of Senators Walter Mondale, Birch Bayh, and Frank Church as a consultant to the Democratic Caucus of the U.S. House. And in 2000, he served as a senior advisor to Senator Chuck Hagel, a Republican from Nebraska, and Patrick Leahy, a Democrat from Vermont. We'll welcome phone calls, and I know there will be many as we talk about when the debate on Iraq. 800-486-8655-227-20. If you're joining us in Milwaukee. Professor Ross Baker, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
All this talk about, well, we're going to have this debate. We want to have this debate. The American people want this debate. Here it is. And then yesterday, well, we're not going to have this debate right now. What happened yesterday in your mind?
The Senate is a very peculiar place. It defies the ability of a political scientist. I really think it needs an anthropologist or a theologian to really unravel it. But basically, here's what happened. You know, I think that, people outside of Capitol Hill sort of feel that, well, senators can kind of just get together and debate when they want to. But in truth, you have to have what's called a vehicle for a debate. That is, you have to have a piece of legislation, whether it's a full bill or a resolution or an amendment actually on the floor to give them something to talk about. But before you can even get to that, there's something called a motion to proceed, which basically means, yes, we all agree to that this needs to be discussed. And this is something that is typically arrived at by unanimous consent. And that literally is the agreement of every last senator that this is something worthy to be talked about.
I see.
And what happened yesterday is that the Republicans denied that that motion to proceed with a discussion of the various resolutions in the war. So they didn't get discussed. And left it really in the hands of the majority leader, Senator Reid, and the minority leader, Senator McConnell, to try to work it out, that something acceptable to both sides would be on the floor and up for discussion.
Well, why wouldn't they want to proceed? Eventually, the debate is going to have to take place. Why not start it yesterday? What were the objections?
Well, the objections were over exactly what it was to be debated.
Oh.
Going back a couple of weeks, there were three senators. It was a bipartisan group got together with Senator Biden, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Hagel, a Republican, who is the second-ranking Republican on that committee, and then Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, came up with a resolution which deplored the escalation of the war. And the word escalation was absolutely an unacceptable term as far as the Republicans were concerned. Then there were other resolutions that came up, and finally they were combined in a resolution that was basically worked out by Senator John Warner, who was the ranking Republican on the Armed Services Committee, which had a more moderate language, and the belief was, well, this was something that would be acceptable enough, was tepid enough to get past the Republicans and get their agreement, get onto the floor.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was that in consultation with the White House, the Republican leadership of the Senate decided that even this would not be acceptable, and that only something that was actually affirming the rightness of the president's
decision,
and moreover, declaring that under no circumstances would appropriations be cut to the military. It's at that point that the impasse got started.
And so for the Democrats to advance this, they would have needed a certain number of votes to say to those Republicans, sorry, we're going ahead?
That's correct. This is one of these situations in which you need 60 votes.
I see.
And, you know, it's probably a good rule of thumb when you're looking at the United States Senate to assume that if anything is important at all, it's going to take 60 votes to pass it.
But why would you have people like Warner and Hagel, who have been very outspoken in their opposition to a surge here and who have fashioned a bipartisan resolution, and Hagel going a step further, why would you have them vote with the party instead of what they've been talking about all these weeks?
This, Kathleen, this was a very strange vote because it comes very early in the session. The Democrats are still a bit uncertain about being in the majority. The Republicans are a little bit hesitant about being in the minority.
Hmm.
And this was, I think, on McConnell's part, really an effort to kind of rally the troops behind something that the leadership believed in. They ended up losing two senators, Senator Coleman and Senator Collins.
Mm-hmm.
But occasionally there are these so-called leadership votes in which there is tremendous pressure on all members, either Democrats or Republicans, to rally to the team. And this was one of those votes. Senator Hagel, I think, believes that something will be worked out between Senators Reid and McConnell that ultimately will kick off debate. So I don't think he's going to remain placated for very long. He's very angry. I spoke to him last week, and he really wants this debate to take place. He thinks it's been postponed entirely too long, and I think he just decided to give McConnell the vote. But I don't think that this situation is going to remain static for very long.
All right. So what's going to change it, and when will we get the debate?
Well, I think what's going to happen is that there will be something that is actually put on the floor, and it may be extremely carefully worded. I think it would almost have to be able to get unanimous consent of both Democrats and Republicans. But at that point, the actual wording of the resolution is less important than the debate that it engenders. That is, that once it's on the floor, you can talk about anything. You know, you can offer other alternatives, you can criticize it, and so on. But I think the feeling among some senators is that this is a debate that has been deferred for entirely too long,
mm-hmm.
that for the entire time that the Republicans were in charge of the were in the majority party in the Senate, this is a debate that just didn't take place. That Senator Lugar, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, is a very cautious person. I mean, he's somebody with tremendous reservations about the war, but very, very reluctant to break ranks with the White House. Now that the Democrats are in control, some Republicans have become liberated, in a sense. Some people like Senator Hagel and Senator Specter from Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the important thing right now, from their point of view, is get something, whatever it is, onto the floor so that, as Senator Hillary Clinton might say, the conversation should begin.
Right. Well, you've also got the American people who are demanding this. They got to listen to their constituents, don't they? I mean, they don't always, but on this issue, for heaven's sake, we had a whole change in the makeup of Congress as a result of this issue.
I cannot believe that Senator McConnell and Senator Lott, the two top Republicans in the Senate, are unaware of this.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a real risk for them. As Senator Schumer pointed out yesterday, Senator McConnell is leading the Republicans over the precipice if he decides that that debate should not take place.
Mm-hmm.
So there will be debate. Mm-hmm. I mean, I cannot imagine that the self-destructive impulses of the Republicans are so highly developed that they would try to dodge debate on this. And I think it's only a matter of time before it happens. And I think that the Republicans are aware of their vulnerability on this, and I think ultimately they will allow something to be debated.
Let's talk just briefly before we go to phones about what the debate's going to center on, probably, and that's this non-binding resolution first, which a lot of people have said is real wishy-washy. It doesn't make a hill of a beans a difference. So what if you say you're not in favor of it, but you don't cut funding and you don't come up with another plan? It's meaningless.
Well, I think the way things work in the Senate is things proceed incrementally. And the problem is the first step hasn't been taken. The first step is debating a resolution. Almost, it doesn't matter what its precise wording is. It's just to get the discussion going. And the assumption is that once that's done, then subsequent steps can be taken which are more definitive and express a greater degree of concern, or even a move in the direction of some real action on the war. But the feeling is that unless that first step, no matter how halting and hesitating it is taken, then really nothing, mm-hmm. no subsequent steps can take place.
Mm-hmm. Phone calls. Rich from Rhinelander, our first call. Hi, Rich.
Hi. To call what is happening idiosyncratic on the part of the Republicans is really profound understatement. I think what I want and what a lot of Americans want is an accounting for this war. And by that I mean we want an open and full discussion. If you want to call it a debate or an argument, fine, but we want an open and full discussion of how are we going to define success.
Mm-hmm.
And very importantly, openness and honesty about how much it is costing and where the costs are placed in budgetary recording of what cost is. And also, because this government, meaning executive branch, has aimed for the privatization of large numbers of services that used to be in the public sector, a lot of money has gone to private sources, and a lot of money is missing. I understand why Republicans, who backed the president in good faith, may be hesitant for all of this to come out, but eventually it will come out, and the faster and the clearer and the more open the process is, better it will be for the Republican Party. The future of the Republican Party, I am sorry to say, is not in the hands of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. And the faster the Republicans learn that message, the better off the party will be.
Professor Baker.
Oh, I agree with Rich completely. And I think that that's the concern of a number of Republican senators who may not express it openly, but certainly privately, would say that they are greatly concerned about the future of the party. They see the 2008 prospect as being very bleak. And I think that you're really going to have to look to, for example, the House of Representatives is going to get started on this first. Congressman Henry Waxman of California is the chairman of the House Committee on Oversight and Investigations. And, you know, he's going to be looking at the contractor question and the situation that Rich referred to, which was basically having civilian contractors, many of whom may be former military people, taking the considerable responsibility for the burdens in Iraq. I mean, if you add the number of contractors who actually carry sidearms or weapons to the number of troops there, the number of armed people who are supposedly working for us goes up considerably. And of course, there have been tremendous problems with cost overruns with the KBR company, the problem with construction with the Parsons company, and so on. All of these things trouble people greatly, even those people who authorized the president to take the nation to war in 2003. I think that the idea that the American people are really having to pay a price not only in blood but in treasure as well is deeply concerning to people in both parties.
Mm-hmm. So next week the House will take up, you just mentioned the contractor question. Will they also be taking up various resolutions on what they think we should be doing in Iraq now?
Yes, there will be a resolution. That's one thing about the House of Representatives, and that is that the majority party is all-powerful. In the House of Representatives, there's no filibuster in the House of Representatives. You don't need to meet the 60 vote threshold.
Mm-hmm.
If you have 218 votes on your side, and those 218 House members are cohesive, and believe me, the 232 Democrats are very cohesive. You can do pretty much what you want.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking for action on the subject, if you're looking for actual votes on a resolution, and it will be a resolution, by the way, it will essentially be the Warner resolution from the Senate, it's going to come from the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Rich, very much for your call. Chris is next from Madison. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Hi.
My big concern is that, you know, the fact that we can't even publicly talk about this thing, and I'm afraid that they are going to be doing something in Iran before we even get to talk about Iraq. It just seems like they, I mean, I know the president is saying that, oh, no, we're not going to do that. Well, you know how, I just don't believe him. And I'm afraid that they, you know, they're beating the drums for Iran like crazy. I mean, every day, oh, some Iranian something is happening. I think it's going to get much bigger before it gets smaller.
Mm. You agree, Professor Baker?
Well, I think it's a matter of considerable concern. I would imagine that from the perspective of the White House, looking at the very puny level of support for the president in Iraq, there's certainly not a lot of support within the American public for extending a war into
right.
Iran.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is what a lot of the debate is about. What we're seeing in Washington, Kathleen, is a struggle for American public opinion.
Mm.
And it's in this kind of battle has taken place before in American life, in the late 1930s, about whether the United States would remain neutral in a European war. Congress passed the Neutrality Act, which very much restricted President Roosevelt's ability to aid the Allies and so on. We had this debate after World War II as to whether the United States would establish the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and really for the first time have a peacetime alliance with European countries. But the public at this point, the public really hasn't been drawn into the debate. Americans have been speaking out. There was a big march on Washington a couple of weeks ago. But the conversation or the dialogue between the elite in Washington, the American public, has not yet been joined. And
mm-hmm.
that's really what this debate is all about in
mm-hmm.
the Senate.
Mm-hmm. How do you get a measure of what American public opinion is on this? I mean, do you look at polls and say most Americans would support non-binding resolution? Most Americans say get out, you know, stop the funding. How do we know how America? Because we were saying a big thing, I think, in the elections. What exactly were we saying? I think we were saying get out when we can, figure out a way to do this. But how is where we're stuck here or what?
You know, it's funny, Kathleen. Americans are unhappy. They are depressed. They are sullen, but for the most part, not yet rebellious. And it's interesting to know, there's a recent book that was published on the relationship between what was going on in Congress and what was going on in the American public in the mid 1960s, as the debate on Vietnam began to develop. And it's interesting that the thesis of this particular book, which is called Elites for Peace, makes the argument that although there was concern on American campuses and so on in, let's say, 1965, it really wasn't until Senator J. William Fulbright, a Democrat and chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, began to hold hearings on the Vietnam War. And in a sense, it was a signal to the American people that the political elite of the United States has taken cognizance of the fact that the war in Vietnam is not going well, and they want questions answered. And I think we're at about that stage. There was an election in 1966, congressional election, in which there was certainly a lot of discontent expressed about the war in Vietnam, but Americans at that point were not arguing for a pullout. And I think, in a sense, we're in the same kind of situation now. There's a lot of unhappiness with the way the war is being conducted, concern about the casualties and so on. But the fact is that there's no widely accepted course of action.
Right.
You know, there are people who want an immediate pullout. There are people who want benchmarks. There are people who want a phased pullout, you know, ending in 2009. There are as many routes out of Iraq or even staying in Iraq as there are members of Congress or influential columnists or commentators.
I was listening to Russ Feingold, one of our senators, last night. He was on television. He's on television a lot these days because he seems to have a plan. But he was taking on the Democrats, saying they're timid, that they have to take on this war more directly, that they need to find a way together to end this war. He's got his own plan, but you know, they're wishy-washy. They don't have any spines here. Is he right? Maybe you wouldn't agree with his plan, but is he right that Democrats are to be blamed for not offering much of a vision here as well?
Well, I think that Democrats and Republicans alike would be terrified at the prospect of voting on a resolution to cut off money for the effort in Iraq and Afghanistan. In fact, that the trap that the Republicans hoped to set for the Democrats was a resolution offered by Senator Gregg of New Hampshire, which in a sense was amounted to a pledge on the part of the United States Senate not to ever cut off money. And no Democrat wanted to be recorded as being opposed to that.
So you
have this tremendous aversion to anything that resembles Senator Feingold's proposal to begin using the power of the purse to cut off money. On the other hand, the tremendous amount of disaffection and unhappiness with the course of the war. And I guess they simply decided that some kind of declaratory statement in between the kind of thing that Senator Feingold and Senator Dodd are talking about and the sort of affirmation of the rightness of the administration's course, that somewhere in between there's going to be a resolution that's going to satisfy 60 senators.
Yeah. And in the meantime, what's troubling, so troubling, Professor Baker, is what's coming, the news that's coming to us from Iraq. I got to tell you, whatever your political belief, when you watch these bombings and the markets and the and kids at school, it just makes you sick. Of course people are going to say, do something differently. This can't continue. This is awful.
Well, you know, in fact, the president really has a free hand until his money runs out on the 30th of September, that even if at this very moment, by some remarkable turn of events, Congress were to cut off funding, there is just so much money already in the pipeline that, you know, the president really, you know, has it within his own province to conduct the war as he wishes from now until September, when the money legally would run out. You know, what we're having to deal with is the administration's assertion that somehow this troop surge is going to make a difference.
Right.
There are some people who seem to be reassured by this, who seem to be, to some degree, convinced by things that the president says or General Petraeus says. You know, nothing dramatic is going to happen for a while. As horrific as the situation is.
Yeah. And people are probably more convinced by what Petraeus says than what Bush says these days, don't you think?
That's probably true. And I think the fact that, you know, that some people found it odd that we would be confirming General Petraeus as commander of the ground forces in Iraq at the same time that we were condemning the policy itself. But, you know, whether or not the United States stays or goes, you're going to need a ground commander. And that's his responsibility.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Ross Baker. We're talking about the wide-ranging debate on Iraq, which was supposed to have been started in the Senate yesterday, but it didn't start yet. And we're looking at resolutions that are on the table that eventually may be discussed. It looks like the House may be debating this earlier than the Senate. What's going on here? What are the rules of the Senate? Why is it that Republicans are sticking with Republicans on this? And all of that. And, of course, the larger question of how is everybody responding to what the American public would like, which I think is a pretty wide-ranging debate about what way forward. Professor Baker is a professor of political science at Rutgers University. He was a research associate at the Brookings Institution before that. He served on the staffs of Senators Walter Mondale, Birch Bayh, Frank Church, and he also has served as a senior advisor to Senator Chuck Hagel and Patrick Leahy, and we're taking on this issue with him. Well, we have one line open if you'd like to grab it, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, Milwaukee 227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, this book is so well done. The guy not only can cook, but he can write as well. We'll be speaking with the author of White House Chef, 11 Years, Two Presidents, and One Kitchen. Walter Scheib will be with us for a number of years. He was the chef for the Clintons, and he also was the chef for the Bush family in the White House. And the book looks at, you know, all the great celebrations, getting the job. It also looks, though, at serious issues of what the White House was like on September 11 and after September 11, and what the administrations were trying to do with their choice of foods. You're going to find him really interesting. I think he was on, my son told me he was on The Daily Show last night, too. So, and Rhonda says he's funny. So we're going to have fun. Our guest, Walter Scheib. White House Chef is his book. Professor Ross Baker is with us now, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Chris is next from Mount Zion. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Professor Baker. I know someone mentioned this earlier. I'm very concerned about war profiteering and the war privatization from the groups like Blackwater to Khaki. And I would really encourage everyone listening to see the movie Iraq for Sale. I've been following this since the get-go in 1999. Senator Bob La Follette, who was a Republican, harshly criticized for bringing up the idea that removing profits from war might eliminate wars. And I think what we have going on right now, and please, maybe the professor could enlighten us to this, is that in this latest war, all the corporations involved are not even taxed higher as in the past wars for their profiteering. There have been more millionaires made in this war than anyone can imagine, and it scares me. I think we're headed down a road of very, very dangerous road, and if the professor could maybe shed some light on what's going on here. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call.
Yes.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's all right.
You know, it's interesting to note that Senator Harry Truman of Missouri really made his political career examining American preparedness for World War II. And one of the things he did, being the kind of plain-spoken tough-minded guy he was, was pointed out the incredible, almost obscene profits that were made, and very often by producing defective materials for the military. Certainly the case in the American Civil War, that very often the troops were sent inferior materials and so on. It's, there seems to be almost a kind of built-in slippage in American morality when it comes to war, that, that rather than seeing the opportunity for national unity or national sacrifice, it seems an opportunity for individual profit and gain. And it's really quite distressing because there's just no doubt in my mind that a lot of these no-bid contracts and so on, which are defended because, you need to get these things done in a hurry, has produced a huge amount of abuse, and I think it's going to be many years before we really get to the bottom of it. Mm-hmm. I think that we're really only only scratching the surface now, and that when it is finally, when the enormity of it is finally revealed, I think, you know, we're really going to be appalled by it, and I wish that, you know, that taking place would somehow prevent us from going through the same thing again the next time we go to war, but I fear it won't.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Have you talked with Hagel about his running for president?
Yes, I did. Well, what happened was I actually called him to talk about the immigration bill of last year, which the Senate versions and House versions were so dramatically different. And he said, "Gee, I really want to thank you because I'm so sick and tired of talking about Iraq. I want to talk about something else." And then at the end, I said, "Listen, well, I gave you a break on Iraq, but you know, let me know what your thoughts are about running." And you know, he's obviously mulling it. I mean, I think he's certainly taking it much more seriously now than he did, let's say, a year ago when he and John McCain were really basically on the same side. And now, of course, he and McCain are very, very different perspectives.
I kind of think he'd be a really strong candidate.
Well, of course, you know, as a Republican, he has to deal with a Republican electorate, which is, you know, not as anti-war as let's say a Democratic electorate. I think he meets many of the other tests.
Yes.
I mean, he is generally conservative on his votes on things like social policy. I mean, he doesn't really care that much about the kinds of things that Sam Brownback, you know, talked about, you know, same-sex marriage, and I think that, you know, although, you know, he hasn't said so, I just don't think that those are things of, I think those are things that are best left to the states to worry about. But the thing he's really passionate about is the war, and it's based on his experiences in Vietnam.
Right.
And also, he and the vice president have an extremely extremely difficult relationship. You know, that the vice president has, you know, went so far in an interview with Wolf Blitzer to kind of single out Senator Hagel for particular criticism. And, you know, the fact remains is that the vice president has been the administration's enforcer. Every Tuesday, the Republicans in the Senate have a policy lunch. And one of the frequent visitors over the last several years has been the vice president. His job has been basically to keep Republican senators in line. To prevent them, as best he can, from speaking out, from holding hearings. And until recently, he's been successful. And now, of course, that the Democrats are the majority party in the Senate, and it's they who set the agenda, it's they who call the hearings, the ability of the vice president to silence even Republicans has been diminished. The vice president is a very angry man for reasons I really don't fully understand. But there's a kind of venomous zeal to much of what he does that it's very difficult to explain purely in political terms.
Let's go back to phone calls. Bob from Spooner, hi.
Good morning. Thank you, Kathleen. My comment may remind you of the Woody Allen line, "I'm being as cynical as I can, I just can't keep up." but directing my comment to Senator Feingold's question about why aren't the Democrats doing more than promoting non-binding resolutions, I think what underlies their thinking is they want President Bush alone to be responsible for the failure in Iraq. And if the Democrats, one way or another, defund the effort, then they will share the blame for the failure in Iraq. If they do nothing, it falls entirely to President Bush. That's my thought.
Professor Baker.
I think that your caller's cynicism is well placed. yes, absolutely. I think that this is a very tempting thing for Democrats to really have the president shoulder the singular burden of the war, and simply not leave any Democratic fingerprints on it at all. Continue to approve the supplemental appropriations for the war. And have the president lead the Republican Party over the precipice. It's, I suppose, in some ways a test of the patriotism of Democrats, but the temptation to engage in payback is very strong among Democrats. I mean, the last several years have been very unpleasant for Democrats, not just in the House, but in the Senate as well, even in the body in which the Democrats in the minority had at least some ability to influence the process. But the wells have been poisoned. For all of the happy talk, I think that followed the Democratic victory in the 2006 election, there is a very, very strong residual resentment on the part of Democrats who feel that they were totally excluded from any involvement in policy during the last 4 years, and there's no reservoir of goodwill. I mean, the president can compliment the speaker. He can call the Democratic Party by its right name.
Yes,
he can make all kinds of symbolic amends, but it's not going to repair a very bleak political landscape.
So how long are we going to give this whole effort? Say, it looks like this surge is going to go forward. Do we give it till next September? What's going to make us feel better about this, or what will make the Senate and the House take stronger action here?
Well, you know, I think that people like Senator McCain are going to be very important in this regard. He is the one who has argued for the so-called benchmarks. Now, there aren't any enforcement mechanisms behind the benchmarks. That's been Senator Hagel's criticism of them. However, of these benchmarks that the Iraqi government is to be held to, Senator McCain has said that they will be judged in months rather than a year. That if, in fact, some kind of benchmark resolution is passed, it's possible that might be one of the ones that's chosen, that there will be some standard by which to judge the performance of the Iraqi government, and that if it's revealed for all the world to see that they've not made it, that may be the break point. But I think that McCain, because of his own prestige and his own aggressiveness, I think is really going to be key in this situation.
We have time for maybe one more phone call. Richard from Fort Atkinson. Hi.
Yes, thank you for hearing my call. Profiteering, victory, the war's not going well. All of these terms, I think, are really superficial. And permit me to suggest that one of the reasons why the Democrats and Republicans are having so much trouble is they're not debating the right issue. If you go back before the fatuous lies of 2002 and 2003 to the prior interval of 2 or 3 years, you could see that Iraq was an economy in ruins, a small country divided into three, where we were bombing the north and the south with impunity, that Iraq was no military threat whatsoever to the United States. And so what that does is make what we did in Iraq with our shock and awe a crime against humanity. It is a terrorist act of atrocity. And no one is willing in our leadership to get up and talk about the moral dimensions of this matter.
All right, I have told you they were almost out of time. Professor Baker, moral dimensions.
Yeah, I'm a little amused sometimes by the president's likening his situation to that of Abraham Lincoln in 1861.
Mm-hmm.
The American Civil War was forced on Abraham Lincoln. He did not elect to declare war on the South, nor did Franklin Roosevelt in 1941. This is the president's war. It's something that he conceived of. It's something he built the case for. It's something he argued for very, very vigorously. And it is he who, after all, proclaimed premature victory. So I think yes, there is very much a moral dimension to this, and I think that the moral burden of it is borne singularly by the Bush administration.
No, well, you come join us any old time. You're a great guest. Thanks, Professor Baker,
for
being with us. Thanks.
Thank your callers too.
Yeah, they're great, aren't they? They're great. Our guest this hour, Professor Ross Baker, professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's the author of a number of books, and he has a great deal of experience on the Hill, serving on the staffs of Mondale, By, Church, and also as a senior advisor to Chuck Hagel and to Patrick Leahy. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program and to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Copies of the show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. The program number of this hour is 26D. News coming up, and we'll return with more Tuesday Conversation here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.